So this is what I'm talk about, and it's work in collaboration with Andrew Todd. To start with, I'll start with some motivations from the string theory and from the cosmology, in particular why two-dimensional two brains are so important in cosmology, and why it's important to understand the back action of these two-dimensional two brains in the bulb. And to do that, from the GR point of view, actually, three-dimensional two brains are not very well-defined objects. So you need to find a way to regularize that before being able to understand this back reaction. And the way we're going to do that is look at our thick brain regularization. And we want physics on the brain or in the bulb, when at low energy compared to this regularization scale, to be independent of it. And if they're not independent, or it is sensitive to the way you regularize it, you want to find a way to renormalize it. So that's really the main goal of this work here. And in particular, we're going to focus on a specific case of six-dimensional procedure combatification, where we have two co-dimensional two brain states, three brains, the input of the combatification. And for this specific case, I will introduce how we regularize it through a thick brain limit, introduce the width of the brain as a Kepler scale, and I see what's the theory on the bulk and on the brain through the back reaction. So that will be our setup, and in the second part, we'll look at the back reaction for this specific case. And then I introduce another way, which has been presented in literature, to regularize the brain, which has been considering the gas relatives in the bulk, which are generally present to string theory. And it has been shown that for infinite extra dimensions, in the dimension 2 case, the presence of these terms actually can regularize the geometry, and you can have localized gravity on the brain. So we can just take this approach and see if it works for our case, where we have complexified six-dimensional geometry, and see if it works. So this will be the last point. First, I'll start with some motivations. So from string theory, B brains are, of course, very important objects, but especially three-dimensional two brains play a special role. And in three-dimensional string theory, it's been shown by these people that B7 brains are favorized objects compared to lower dimensional brains with B3 brains. And there's been a lot of work on inflation between B7 and B3 brains. So just to tell you, this three-dimensional two brains are very special objects. They want to be focused. But the way they studied it in string theory is usually through a pro-brain approximation. So when you neglect the back reaction of the brain, you just have a geometry, and then you put a test brain in this, and you see how it evolves. And of course, that doesn't allow you to understand the back reaction of this brain, which we are interested in. But if you take this pro-brain approach, usually we can find a four-dimensional effective theory in the brain at lower energy. And what we want to do is go a little bit beyond that. So either way you can do is take this low energy effective approach and then correct it by some modification due to the presence of the bulb. So by introducing some higher derivative terms, some kind of Kaluza-Klein correction on the four-dimensional effective theory. So this, it would be equivalent to have a four-dimensional effective theory, and then you add some either irrelevant operators. And that's a well-defined thing to do, as long as the operators you have an inference which is weaker and weaker on the Fourier effective theory. If it's not the case, but if you have an incompatified theory, and the effect of all these operators is of the same level, then you might want to go to a fully high-dimensional description of the theory. But we work in a regime where we assume this method would be completely valid, in particular because we want to express things in terms of four-dimensional quantities and not in terms of the higher-dimensional theory. So this is what we concentrate on. From the cosmological point of view, by the ABD scenarios, I've been shown that having some large extra dimension might need a potential explanation for the hierarchy problem, which is why the planet mass is so different from the electroweak mass. And the reason for that is that you have a fundamental Planck mass, which is of the same order of magnitude as the electroweak mass, but the one you effectively see on the brain is actually integrated over the entire volume. So in particular, it's been shown in the ADD model that if you have two kind of large extra dimensions, it could be that the fundamental Planck mass would be of order TV, so of order of the electric mass. If you had two extra dimensions of order 0.1 millimeter, more or less. And the reason for that is that the Planck mass on the brain is related to the fundamental one through the integration of the volume. So that could give you a potential explanation of the hierarchy problem. And really what you do is change the hierarchy problem between the electroweak mass and the Planck mass to another hierarchy problem, which is weaker, between the two large extra dimensions and the small compactified extra dimension, which are compactified on the torus order, the string scale. But it's a weaker hierarchy problem, and as well as a dynamical problem, because you can understand that we can give some potential new resolution of this problem. You can understand that a bit more. This might appear a funny thing to do, because on the brain we just observe fully rational gravity, and we don't really observe higher dimensional dimension. But actually, it's not quite true, because gravity has only been tested for scales of under 0.1 millimeter, more or less, and to be accurate, to four-dimensional gravity. But there's no reason that you have modified gravity only at the strain scale. It could be that between the strain scale and this 0.1 millimeter scale, you could still have modified gravity, and you could see some signature of the presence of extra dimension in that case, which hasn't been observed yet. But so there's still some potential for this scenario to be true. Another important conclusion from this result is that it could connect with the observability of the cosmic constant on our universe. In particular, the cosmic constant is observed to be a bit embarrassing small. And if you could just consider its unit length to the minus 4. And naively, you could just take this 0.1 millimeter here and plug it in the value in the as the unit it should be, 0.1 to the minus 4. And actually, it gives you an order of magnitude which is primarily close to what we observe for the current cosmic constant. But so far, we haven't done anything. We just see something which has the right unit and then plug the number in. For this mechanism to make sense, we really need to understand where this 0.1 millimeter to the minus 4 would come in. For that, you have to go to the stress-energy latitude and dimension model. But first, you want to relate the cosmic constant on the brain to more fundamental values you have in the dog, so six-dimensional value if you're working with four-dimensional two brains. So you can think of the four-dimensional cosmic constant as being the integration over the vacuum potential of the six-dimensional integrator of the six-dimensional dog. And if you do that, you'll as well have some curvature corrections, due to the fact that the bulk might be curved, which go like 1 bar squared corrections. So this is the leading terms you naively expect. Due to curvature correction, you have all these kind of terms coming in. So the cosmic constant would naively be of this order of magnitude.
Question?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you're going to deal with this later, but what keeps this, the geometry of these two extra dimensions stable?
Okay.
What keeps them from, since it's very small, what keeps it from gravitationally collapsing to a singularity or expanding?
Yeah, we'll see later on a scenario where it's compactified, so the size of the extra dimension is finite, and for the background, it's just stable that way. Then you could have some scale perturbation, and you might have some unstable mechanism that makes them either collapse or make them infinite, which you don't want. And so you need to introduce some stabilization mechanism, which it's an issue I'm not going to consider right now. I think it's as well related to the stabilization mechanism of completely natural boundary.
Right, but if you're not going to deal with it, is there a stabilization mechanism? No.
I'm not sure. I think people would consider stabilization mechanism. I'm not sure exactly what you would do to do that.
In the original picture, that it is running to infinity, and that's the dark energy.
Right, but why doesn't it, I mean, if it's, why couldn't it say gravitation collapse with the time scale of, you know, the light crossing time going around the thing?
Well, the instability, I'm not sure what the instability is that you have in mind, but the instability this potential gives you is for a runaway, or wants to be a exponential collapse.
Is this a version of Kluge's applied theory where general relativity applies at the six-dimensional level?
Yeah.
Then there's gravity as the instability mechanism. If I have a compact connection, it can collapse.
It can, but so maybe we talk about later, but the instability that the dominant one here is for to get larger rather than get smaller.
You believe that?
Well, no, it depends. So then there's a chronological issue, is that can that describe what we see? And it can actually describe the dark energy. It doesn't generically describe the dark energy, but it can do so. But
anyway, this is off topic. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. So now you would expect this term to be the lead one. But now if you consider supersymmetry to be broken up scales 1 over r, you would actually have cancellation of these first term, the cancellation between the fermions and the bosons. So these terms could actually not be there to be in order. And if you do some computation of loop diagrams, it could be that the two following terms here won't be present as well. And so you remain with this final term, which is exactly what you want, for the cosmic constant to be what we observe with just this 0.1 millimeter size of the two extra dimensions. So this is really nice. It could give you, just through the 0.1 millimeter, it could give you an explanation for the ERP problem plus for the cosmic constant problem. So it's really related to three fundamental quantities of cosmology in one go. So I'll say that the supersymmetry should be broken up order 1 over r scales. But on the brains, we know that supersymmetry is broken order TeV or higher. So it's not the same level at which, the same order of magnitude at which the supersymmetry is broken on the brain and on the ball. And in particular, it's very important to understand if supersymmetry being broken in the brain, on the brain, could have some back reaction on this process in the ball. So this is really one of the main motivations of why we want to understand the back reaction of the brain, looking back on the brain or what's going on the brain, into the ball. And then what's the consequences for quantities on the brain eventually. So this is really the procedure we'll take. And we won't go so far as looking at supersymmetry, but we'll just take a first step within this direction. Just introduce some matter on the ball and then see what the consequences are for the entire geometry. If you want to do that, you could argue that a lot has been done already for cosmic strings. I could imagine two brains can just be seen as cosmic strings. It's true, and that's really the way we're going to regularize it. It's motivated by cosmic strings, and we'll use a William Higgs field theory to do that. But when people were looking at cosmic strings, they weren't really thinking of us living on these cosmic strings. And what we want to do now is us living in these three-dimensional two brains. So we want to introduce matter on these brains and see if it's cosmologically viable. So by that, you want to know how does gravity look like? Is it localized or not? Does it look like four-dimensional gravity or not? What does the Feynman equation look like? And is it stable or not? All sorts of cosmic questions you want to raise. And to do that, as I said, we will regularize the geometry on this three-dimensional two brain and see whether or not the theory is dependent, is sensitive of the way you regularized it, and is sensitive for the cutoff scale. In fact, at low energy, much lower than the cutoff scale. And if it is, then if there's a way to renormalize this theory. So that's the main goal of this work now. But I can first start with some previous work. In particular, a lot of work has been done for infinite extra dimensions. I was talking about Fenner and Soda 3 years ago. If you consider infinite large extra dimension, then it's very difficult to localize gravity on the brain. Just if you consider the ADD scenario, then the volume of the extra dimension is infinite, so you don't really know how to make sense of this relationship between the fundamental atomic mass and the four-dimensional one. And as well, they see the presence of log divergence. But what they see is that it's a remarkable fact. If you use the Gassmann determinants, which are generically present in the bulk, then you can remove this log divergence, and the gravity seems to be localized on the grain. And not only localized, but it really looks entirely four-dimensional. So this is a result which has been done for infinite extra dimension, with a size of the extra dimension being infinite. Some other work has been done for still infinite extra dimension, but with a finite volume because they warped. You know, these people, Giovanni, in 2001. And that is seen that for this case, because the volume of the extra dimension is finite, you can have localization of gravity on the grid. But further studies for this specific case cannot be done because already at this level, they use numerical simulation. So it's very hard on the top of this numerical simulation to induce matter and see what's going on. But I think this is a very good direction to work to. As well, concerning the stability, this has been shown very recently, last month, that in general, if you have two co-dimensional two brains, so the case we have considered compactified geometry with two co-dimensional two brains, it seems to be unstable against scale of perturbations. And you have a moduli stabilization problem, as you said. Although I'm not quite sure what would be the specific regularization scheme, or if you want to pick them.
In pure gravity, or what was the calculation that you did? When you say there's an instability, is that an instability in pure gravity, or what's the theory in which they're doing the instability?
Yeah, they're putting some matter on the ground and they look at, it's just pure gravity, and they look at perturbations. And they find some instabilities for scalar perturbations.
Yeah. In the second case, so you say, so you only have, is it a single?
Yeah, it's a single dimension too.
And is it, so in the geometry or in front of it?
For this case it's warped. It's really very similar to the Randall Sunder model, like the Randall Sunder too, where you just have one brain. Only for that case, the brain can be localized just at one point. You don't have a one parent family where you can put the brain. But otherwise it's just a stability. It doesn't look warped close to the brain, but then when you go to infinity, it does look warped. And the size of the extra dimension is just finite.
So is there a stress tensor in the bulk
resistance? No, this is a positive cosmic constant.
I guess,
so you have the voltage.
So it's n, so it's under the zipper?
Yeah. Far away from the brain at infinity is just under the zipper, and close to the brain is suddenly more fast and you can have that the brain. This is a very specific solution where you have to fine tune other figure.
This is the ADSL one, I guess. There's like a brain in the middle, like a disc that goes off infinity and the brain is in the middle.
Yeah.
Because there was an earlier stability work that I think Jim Klein and others did a couple of years before on that particular solution.
On this specific solution?
And on the ADSL, the six-dimensional landing consider solution in pure gravity that goes off and it's interfaced asymptotically.
The
goal from the middle.
Is that where you're regular, when you cut off the kinetic three-dimensional by putting a co-dimensional one brain?
They often did that, yeah. They find a volume there. They weren't trying to localize it, but the stability issue they were like.
But here, the way we can avoid this problem is just not to look at scalar perturbations at all. We don't say the problem doesn't exist. We just want to focus on a very specific case, which is the back reaction of the three-dimensional two-brain. So we don't want to solve everything at once. And to focus on this problem, we're not going to look at scalar perturbation and concentrate on the intensive perturbations, where the stability problem is not an issue at all. So that's the specific case we'll consider of six-dimensional compactification. So the geometry we look at is completely compactified like that, football shape. And the compactification is followed by a positive cosmic constant in the bulk. And you can as well have some fluxes be present in the bulk. It doesn't modify really the form of the compactification. It just gives you a bit more degrees of freedom to play with. The reason why we're especially interested in compactified cases with either two co-dimension two brains or one co-dimension two brains, and then a smooth geometry on the other side, is because then you know exactly which boundary condition you can impose at both poles, which wouldn't be the case if you have an infinite expansion. You know what's going on at one point, but it's much more subtle to define the boundary condition at infinity. And so this is not an issue for us. We cannot know directly what's the boundary condition of both points. And in particular, you want the derivative of the four-dimensional geometry to be finite to cancel on the three-dimensional two brains, so that you have a smooth geometry then. The other specific point we're going to consider, as I said, is four-dimensional tensor perturbations. So the reason for that is that it avoids some ambiguities when you define the geometric conditions. In particular, we're going to regularize the brains to consider a thick brain, and then the matter you put in is some six-dimensional stress energy tensor, which in the thin brain limit would go to a four-dimensional stress energy tensor. But there's some ambiguity in general between the relationship of this four-dimensional stress energy tensor and the six-dimensional one, which you won't have if you just look at tensor perturbations. The ambiguities come from the vector and scalar models. And in particular, putting some four-dimensional tensor perturbation just corresponds to putting some conformal matter on the brain. So maybe it's not the most general case to consider, but it's a really physical case. You can do that very well. But yeah, I have to stress that for the background, we just have some tension for the brains. So it's one kind of matching for the brain. And then at the perturbed level, we put some tensor perturbation source. So that's a different kind of matter, one proton on the top, and we want to understand the back reaction of this different kind of matter into the dot geometry. So for that, we'll just base our work on the paper by Nikiyama in June last year. When we consider six-dimensional gravity with a positive cosmotic constant in the bulk, and as well some fluxes which can be present. And I have to stress these terms are definitely present, but you don't really need to consider them too. Everything I say can be done without these terms. This just gives you more degrees of freedom to play with. So if you consider this action, the solution is given by this metric, where this f is the Wolf factor along the extra dimensions, and cumulative here is the metric on the brain, which is the seizure. So it's the seizure, six-dimensional amplification.
Excuse me, just if you can now be very specific. So the coordinates x are three-dimensional coordinates or four-dimensional coordinates, right?
Yeah. So this is the coordinate x are the conics along the brain direction. Along where we will live. And these two, R and phi, are the extra dimensions. So in particular, we parameterize it with a radial coordinate R and then an angular coordinate phi. Yeah. Oh. And then the size of this extra dimension will be warped by this warping factor. And on the brain, you'll have this warping factor here, which will be zero, so you have a co-dimension two brain at that point. In general,
So the brain lives at r equals zero.
No, the brains that live where this
zero
function is zero.
This where?
Where this function is zero. So this function can't have two zeros, two real zeros. It has a lot of zeros, but it has two real zeros. If you have the parameter lambda, which is the cosmic constant, and mu, which is associated to the bulk black hole mass, within a range of these two variables, you have two real zeros. And f is positive between these two zeros. The brains live at the two zeros of this function f.
And the r coordinate is a circle, or is... I'm confused about this. Maybe if you could draw it and say what the...
So, you have a triple shape kind of geometry, if you want. And here you have r. Here, if you want, I drew the function f. And at that point here and there, you have your brains. And then you have an angular variable.
Okay, and so what are the killing fields?
Sorry?
What are the killing fields?
The
killing fields, the symmetries.
Oh, I don't know, you have to look at it. When you consider a solution which are axial asymmetric. So we don't put any dependence on phi, on the angular variable. Yeah, and we just put some dependence on R. And for the background, we just consider, well, because maybe we just consider everything to be in the same out of the x direction. So we don't put any x dependence within this direction to start with. And then we can have some for perturbations, because we'll put matches. So we have some perturbations along this direction.
Okay, no, I think that. And the four dimensions is a de Sitter.
Yeah.
It's based on.
You could have for a specific manager, you could have in those fields in that major. But the general solution is this engineer.
The analytic continuation of a black hole, double analytic continuation of a black hole matrix?
Yes.
If it's a double analytic continuation.
If you want to have some. The black hole kind of curves one way, and then it curves the other way. Yeah.
No, I think it's a different question. But that is a...
So the two zeros will be kind of two horizons or two... And so you keep the region in between.
Yeah, we do, yeah. That's different. And it's the...
Sorry, what is L and H? Are they constants?
So H is the Hubble parameter.
Okay.
So it's what gives you the de Sitter. And L is just a parameter which has a unit length. So that is has a unit length. And we introduce it so that the angle variable here just goes from 0 to 2 pi. And then the effective size of this dimension is given by that. Yeah. So otherwise, we could have solved this L into the So this is the background solution when you consider and then we look at perturbations around them by looking at perturbation only four dimensional ones, so only within here. That's the kind of solution. We have some conical singularities where the brains are. Considers two zeros on the function f in R plus and R minus. And if you're close to the brain, you can see that the metric looks like Minkowski, but with a deficit angle given by that. And the tension of the brain is related to this value here. So in particular, if f prime on the brain is plus or minus 2, then you can have a solution where you have no brain, it's just smooth. You don't see any. That is the tackle. And the idea is to regularize this geometry here in such a way that you have a smooth geometry. So for that, we'll just use a model of Abelian Higgs theory, and we just replace it by a thick brain instead of the thin brain limit we have here. So this is more or less the shape you would have symbolically. So we had here the conical singularity, and instead we replace it by a smooth geometry in the thick brain. And we consider the brain to have a width of order epsilon. So this will be the cutoff scale we'll consider. And when we take this epsilon back to zero, we want to have back the thin brain limit, which was the case we considered before. And particularly, we don't want to be too much sensitive of the detail of this regularization. We don't want to know exactly what's the form of the solution within this thin brain. So to do that, it's a sensitive thing to think that I think far away, it's not very, it won't be sensitive of what's going on there, but it will be sensitive of the overall effect. So we can integrate over this brain thickness here in order to get some, what will be the equivalent of junction conditions. So to understand what's the back reaction of the matter we put in here to the bulk geometry or to the nearby geometry. I call the upper surface here, which is kind of the end of the weak brain, the thick brain, R quiddle quantities, and R plus or minus is just the beginning of the thick brains. So by integrating over the Einstein equation, we'll get something which looks like these are the conditions for what would be a three-dimensional brain within this hypersurface. I said before that I can say that we want the derivative of the metric to be zero at this one here, just one, in order to be smooth. But it doesn't necessarily have to be zero at that point here, as we'll see. So we introduced some six-dimensional matter within this thick brain. But what we're really interested in is of its overall effect, so its integral effect here, which is a four-dimensional stress fatigue tensor. So in particular, we're not interested really on the distribution of this six-dimensional stress energy we put in the, on the thick brain. And what we really want to understand is the relationship through T4, maybe, to the bulk-dimensional and height-effect set. So we'll take Einstein equations. So this is the Einstein equation. And this six-dimensional stress energy, for the background, it just has the Boltzmann-Moller tensor in all the terms. And then for the background, it has as well the stress energy tensor we put on the thick brain. And here we just decompose the six-dimensional quantity in terms of four-dimensional ones. In particular here, this can be used as extrinsic curvature. So when the brain is static, it's just a derivative of the metric of the brain. And as I say, we'll integrate them over the brain thickness, so over R plus to the R pseudo quantities. So this is still the four-dimensional reaching tensor. And if we integrate over these two quantities, we'll just give you something of order epsilon, because we integrate something of a width epsilon. And then this term here, we can integrate it exactly. And because this is the derivative of the metric, we know that on the brain itself here, at the end of the brain, it has to be zero, but at the point of arcuidal, it doesn't necessarily have to be zero. So we can evaluate it here. And then when we integrate this term, it just gives you the four-dimensional quantity. So we have something which is very equivalent to what we do to Zweimatter condition. And it tells you how putting matter on this connection to brains affect the nearby geometry by affecting the derivative of the metric close to the brain, so by this process. So this is the regularization scheme we'll introduce, so we're just interested in these kind of boundary conditions. So now we'll apply this to the compactified six-dimensional geometry we considered. So we have this geometry with thick brains, and we'll look at perturbation on the four-dimensional metric here, sourced by some six-dimensional stress energy tensor put on this with brain, thick brain, or the four-dimensional one when we integrate them. In particular, because we consider only tensor perturbation, we want this tensor to be transverse along the four-dimensional quantities. So now we have everything. We have the Einstein equation, and we had what was the boundary condition, the junction conditions. So if we look at the Einstein equation at the perturbed level, we have terms which are derivatives along the radial direction. And then we have a term here which corresponds to derivative along the brain direction. So this thing here would really be a box, a case for a momentum, if we were on Minkowski in the brain or along the x direction. But because it's the structure is slightly more complicated, it depends on age. But it doesn't matter. For what we're going to say, you can just think of this term as just being the derivatives along the x direction, just a box term. So we have this equation here, and now we have the boundary condition given by that. So in principle, we can solve everything. But what we're going to do, because this set function is not really trivial, it's not completely trivial to solve this exactly, we'll work in a lower energy approximation. So we'll consider the box term to be negligible compared to the derivatives along the radial direction. And so for that, we'll first solve this equation being zero, and then we introduce the correction coming from that as an expansion in box. So this is what we're going to do. We expand the solution as a derivative expansion. We put all the box operators one after the other. And that makes sense if this relation is true. So this is a well-defined thing to do, especially when we have a compactified extra dimension. It's less trivial to do when we have an infinite extra dimension because there's no mass gap between different kinds of time, which there is in this case.
Is H related to R? Is it R related to L, I guess, with the size of the extra dimension?
If H is really, no, H, we can put H to be whatever. Yeah, it's the Hubble radius, yeah. This is not really nicely written that way. You just want something which is dimensionless.
I'm wondering why you use H rather than the Hilbert-Feynman scale.
You could use another scale here, it's just because you have an H.
Just mathematics.
Yeah, just because you have an H coming in here. That's why it's easier to put a box over H. But when you actually do this expansion and you look at the solution and then you look at the ratio between the first mode correction to the zero mode, you'll see that it's not really box of R square, we can say the box of a lambda box. Square root lambda box. Right, something with lambda, not with H.
Let me just ask a zero-third question. Before you study the perturbations, you just have a solution of Einstein's equations in six dimensions. So in the theory you have two parameters, which are the lambda and the Planck mass, the six-dimensional Planck mass.
Yeah.
And in the solution you have two parameters, which is the H and the L. Is there some simple relation amongst these four parameters from solving Einstein's?
So you mean between the Planck mass and the lambda? The L just comes in.
Sorry,
the L here comes in. I don't think there's any relationship between these L and the lambda, I think.
So
there's an important thing that goes back to your first question. There's the instability you're thinking about. The thing that I didn't tell you was that classically it's marginally stable because the magnetic flux that was the gauge field that's running around, that makes things not want to shrink. And you're balancing that against the curvature terms and the magnetic flux likes the space to get big and the gravity likes it to get small. And then the scale invariance gives you a flat direction. And so there's a parameter hidden in that.
Which is that B there?
The B is just related to the flux fields you put.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is the freedom to adjust flux, to adjust the B, lets you have any L and H you like, so that you're not fixed to a situation where the scales of the theory determine the scales of the solution. Basically.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's not just, you just don't have lambda and then
you
fix everything. I think you have some
degrees. Yeah, I'm saying a little ironic because I'm used to the supersymmetric case where it's a non-stop flat direction. It's true that you have to tune. There's a relationship between the four-dimensional Hubble scale and the six-dimensional cosmological constant, isn't there? Because I know if you have a flat solution, you'd have to tune the cosmological constant six dimensions against the flux to get the four-dimensional.
I don't think here there's a relationship between the H and the lambda here. You can put any H you want in this solution.
It's R plus minus is the actual.
The tension of the brains are related to this lambda and to this B, and where they are exactly. This will be related. But you can put this H to be 1 if you want. I just put it H so you can see where the dimensionality comes from. But there's nothing here. I haven't had any solution. I haven't had any relationship here. If you start with the lambda here, then you naturally have a black hole mass there. And here is parameter B. You can take anything you want as well. And the H as well.
You're saying naively there would have also been two tensions that you could have adjusted, but those have been adjusted already.
Yeah. So these tensions, are related to the F prime here. These quantities related to the brain tension. Yes, and so this brain tension has to be tensioned with the Bulkus constant. Yeah.
Okay.
And the other parameters. Yeah.
So another way to say it is that if you go back to your F, there's also your parameter mu. So basically, your solution has four parameters, mu, b, h, and l, and the Einstein equations has two parameters, and the Einstein equations, since it's axially symmetric, are basically two equations.
Yeah.
So you get two relations amongst these six constants, and then you determine mu and b in terms of everything else, or something like that.
If you want. Yeah. So going back to before, we do this derivative extension, and then we expect that for lower energy, they will be dominated by the zero node, so just the previous equation where you neglect the box. And in that case, I'll skip you the details, you just get a solution of this form. This is really nice, because first, it's already finite in the Klingberg limit. When you take epsilon goes to zero, these r trivial quantities, you just replace them by the r quantities, and this is completely finite. So already this is nice. Second, this looks like four-dimensional gravity. It's just the, if you put the box here, it just looks like the Ricci tensor, and then it's related directly to the stress energy tensor you put on the rings. And it's as well very similar to what you have for co-dimensional one branch, for instance, such as if you take the other branch to be very far away, it won't be so much sensitive of what kind of matter you put in there, because this factor here will go to zero. So that seems to make a lot of sense. And what's even much nicer is that you have a relationship between your fundamental gravitational coupling constant to the effective four-dimensional one here, which comes in there, which is actually exactly what would be expected by the AVD scenario, for instance, not really by integrating out over the extra dimensions, but by looking what's the relationship between the four-dimensional quantities and the six-dimensional ones, as you can see here. So you expect you have the fundamental gravitational coupling constant, which is a factor in front of the six-dimensional action. And you expect the four-dimensional quantity, which would be what is in front of a four-dimensional action. So to relate the two, you have to decompose these six-dimensional quantities in terms of four-dimensional ones, and then you integrate over the two extra dimensions. And when you do that from one dimension to branch to the other one, you have actually, it's not really the size of the extra dimension, but it's something related which has this form there. So it gives you a relationship between these two parameters, which is exactly what we had before. And I think this is really nice, because what people do usually, for instance, in the AVD scenario, to understand what will be the relationship between the two quantities, is a calculation of this form, which goes from one to the other. But what we did is non-trivial. We get exactly the same result, but we went through a regularization scheme, and then it's not, I mean, it's a nice trick, but it wasn't so obvious to start with that we get precisely the right result with precisely the right coefficients and everything. So I think this is really beautiful. It's a really nice check of what we're doing seems to make sense and goes towards our intuition.
I'm surprised there's an H in it. Why is H there in the...
It comes in there because, well, you have... There, on the brain, really, you have a term which goes like H squared, R squared, and then the human metric on the brain. And then on the brain, really, the H squared, the effective double constant on the brain should go like R squared.
That's part of your work factor.
The R squared. So really, you can replace this term by 1 over R plus or minus square. It depends on which brain you're talking on. So it's really more the effective double constant you would see on that brain. So yeah, I'll write it later in terms, it's more intuitive. We get it first in terms of R squared plus or minus. And then I rewrote it in terms of H squared, so that we can see actually it corresponds to the same on both brains. And it relates to this mechanism where P got an H squared through integration over the
I think I have a really stupid question. So the epsilon root is zero, is it?
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit confused on your junction condition, because you had a term that you said was over epsilon and you dropped it, but
yeah.
But somehow, so when I take epsilon to zero, the thickness of the brain goes to zero, and doesn't the curvature, as soon as I'm adding some stress tensor, then the curvature would blow up.
Well,
so in some sense, the coefficient of epsilon, in some.
You don't. I think you could consider, as an ideal case, you can consider just a delta function. You put some six-dimensional stress energy, which is actually some four-dimensional one, times a delta function, and then you integrate over the brain thickness. But you can take, and it gives you just some value. But then you can take the limit epsilon goes to zero, and it will still give you the same result at that point. So that you consider it to be smooth. It's not. You consider the metric to be smooth within the Richter brain thickness. It's not flat. Right. The brain, the geometry itself, the perturbation themselves, they're not flowing up at some point in the geometry. And I was kidding. And we consider them to be smooth within the brain thickness. Yeah. Later on, I'll express exactly all the terms, and we can integrate them and see which one gives what. Nothing more clear in that case. Which one we can actually neglect and which ones have a real application. Maybe more clear when we did, because I just wrote this R, and really it'd be more clear if I decompose it in terms of the H. And then see what do we need. Yeah. So what we have here was for the zero node. And then we want to go a little bit further, as I said. Probably we want to look at the first kind of Kaluza-Klein derivative correction to this zero node here. So I skip again the calculation. What you get is that on each brain, plus or minus, you get a first Kaluza-Klein correction which diverges logarithmically. So this seems really bad to start. The kind of nice feature is it actually just depends on the content of the matter itself. So if, in particular, if you have a smooth brain, if you have a smooth geometry on one point and you don't put any, it has no tension, you don't put matter on that point at the perturb level, then actually the it won't diverge logarithmically at all, it will just be finite. And in the log, this is just on the brains, but in the log, you don't have this divergent term. You just have some regular terms coming in. So it's really on the brain themselves that something is going on, and you want to, you would like to renormalize this term here. We can think that the presence of this log divergence is actually not surprising. We started in the background with a solution which is isotropic. But the general solution would be an isotropic Casman-like, and it has some log divergence when we go to perturbations. And actually, by treating some anisotropic kind of matter, we tend to this more general solution, which gets some log divergence. So we think the presence of this log divergence we're seeing here is just a signature of this fact and has to be as expected. One point to say that if this is the case, then the divergence would just get worse and worse to next order in the perturb theory. But it actually won't get worse to next order in the derivative expansion we used. So it's not a default of the method we use doing this derivative expansion and looking mode by modes. This is just fine. And actually, if you looked at the following modes, we could see that they're all completely fine. So there's just a unique logarithmic divergence coming in the first Kaluza-Klein mode and not on the other ones. So this is more or less nice because it's not good to have a divergence, but having a log divergence is the best you can have if you need to have a divergence. What I may point out as well is that it is in codimension 2, and we do get log divergence. But it's not related, or at least you don't think it's related, to the divergence you generally have in the Green function, like you have in string theory, because its worksheet is two-dimensional. It's different. And because it comes from this process, we'll expect it to be present for higher three-dimensional brains as well, although this is working for us.
It would probably be worse than logarithmic at that point, maybe the powers of logarithmic epsilon, yeah?
So I'm working on that in the moment. It could be that it could be worse than logarithmic. But if we consider this, if it really comes from this fact, then it shouldn't get worse than logarithmic, actually. The process it goes through is very similar. So I think it should be logarithmic.
But the powers in the Casman-like solution depend on the number of codimensions there are, right? So I can imagine that could affect. I don't understand exactly the connection between the Casman-like solution and the logarithm. The powers depend on dimension.
It's because I think if you have something which is going like that, and then you have some R to some pattern A, and then the thing. if you consider A to be small, then the first order you have that, but then you have plus A log R, EA log R, something like that. Terms coming on.
And A is small because you're the other the
because we consider because we consider some isotropic solution to start with. So all the sum of all these coefficients has to be zero, and if we want them to be isotropic, they all has to be zero to start with. But then we put some isotropic one, and all of them we can have a different coefficient coming in, which the sum which are not zero anymore. So if it comes from this fact, we would expect them to still be logarithmic divergent for higher combinations. But this is still a work in progress. I can't tell you exactly what the answer, but our feeling is that it really goes like that. I really think this is some divergence for higher combination things.
Yeah. Simple question. In 3 plus 1 gravity, with if you model the cosmic string by some big thing and then took the limit as the same limit you're taking, would the same issue arise?
For a codimension 2 or for a codimension, sorry, which set of is that?
So just for a cosmic string in 3 plus 1 dimensions.
For a cosmic string, it's actually, for a real cosmic string, it's a one-dimensional manifold, so it's, you can't really write something like that, because it's just one-dimensional.
Right, but if you imagine that it was modeled the same way by some kind of...
There's an issue of how you put some tensor matter on a cosmic string. This is not a well-defined thing to do on a cosmic string itself, yeah. If it was a two-dimensional cosmic string in a four-dimensional background, probably that would happen. But I think there is an issue for cosmic strings themselves on how well defined it is to put some tensor matter on it. Yeah. So for that specific point, I'm not quite sure how well defined it will be. So as I said, the logarithmic divergence is Kilnstein was just notified by the matter on the brain itself. And the zero mode is the same on both brains. So it's clear, well, it seems that you can't renormalize this divergence by redefining the stress energy tensor you put on each brain, or by redefining your gravitational coupling tensor. Because if you did that, then it would remove the logarithms exactly the same way on both brains, but the log averages doesn't come in the same way on both brains. So that's not, unless you don't care about one brain, you just care about your own brain and you just do things so that it works there. But I don't think this is a very physical thing to do.
We were talking this yesterday, that there's another way you can think about it, that if you're really in a moment where your log energy is compared to the size of the entropy of the time scale, say, then you can't distinguish where the two brains are because you're not using.
I'll come to that later. Okay. Just to start with, I'll say something about introducing some higher directive terms in the ball. You might think that if you introduce some higher directive terms in the ball, that might introduce some new degrees of freedom that will allow you to get rid of the divergence on both brains simultaneously. But I don't think that's very well defined either, because it will be at the price of putting it in the ball again. And unless you consider a theory which with an infinite number of new degrees of freedom, you won't be able to do that.
Well, I wasn't thinking that so much. I was thinking that if you were really in a limit where you integrated out all the fixed time modes and all you were following was the one zero mode metric thing that would appear in the four-dimensional world with the graviton, if you can't actually tell where that field is evaluated in extra dimensions because you don't see the extra dimensions because they've been integrated out.
Yeah, so is it related to...
Well, the only thing you'd be looking at then would be the average of H over the extra dimensions, and that would be like the sum of H plus H minus, and then it wouldn't necessarily be clear that you would have a problem in that field.
I see, yeah. Yeah,
so you're asking a different question, but if you're in the hard limit where you're looking only at zero mode, the problem necessarily wouldn't arise. But if you're interested in clean cosmology on the scales of the Kluge-Klein scale, then
there's
issues there.
Yeah. Oh, that's true, yeah. As you say, you can as well reconsider how you interpret the brain thickness and where it is exactly you are on this brain thickness. It's not necessarily that you are this or here. But this seems to be a little bit arbitrary to do, at least we don't have a very well-defined method to do that so far. If you consider, for instance, the metric to be of this form within the brain thickness, then you have the difference between the two points, which would be of order log epsilon t. So where you are in brain thickness would introduce a term like that. So that could be a way to renormalize it. But yeah, it's really very much work in progress. So it'll be very interesting to see how we could do that. Not just to finish very quickly, I'll talk about the gas functions which have been introduced and do seems to regularize this logo divergence, at least for infinite exponential functions. The nice thing about the gas monotones is that they really generally second order derivatives and have four dimensional as they are here. And if you have gas monotones on the bulk, you can integrate them by part and get some terms in the boundaries which look like Einstein-Hilbert term. And that's a bit how we can localize gravity on that brain. And then see how this is more or less how it does the trick for infinite exponential. So these are the gas monotones we'll consider. And we'll see them their effect for a specific case. So for that, I'll go to another limit of our theory, which is the Kalitaka limit, where the metric on the brain is actually Minkowski, not the CT anymore. And the reason for that is that it's going to be much clearer what's going on, rather than looking at the previous case and doing turn by turn. So it's just a much well-defined limit of what was going on before, and you'll see immediately what's happening. We have the same setup with two brains located at these spots. And if I look at calculations around this metric, the H, the tensor variations, have this functional equation of this form, where this box now is without box because it's Minkowski. And the solution of this equation is just given by that with the notion of P and the notion of Q functions. And we know that these functions have log divergence when at plus or minus 1, so when rho is plus or minus 4c, so are the two brains. So that's really where the logarithmic divergence comes in, and it doesn't get worse than logarithmic divergence. This parameter m is related to the box quantities. So H diverges logarithmically on both brains out of the CP4. And that's in the absence of the gas monotones. And now we want to see how well the gas monotones do to regulate this, or to get rid of the log divergence. The nice thing about the gas monotones within the specific geometry is that they completely vanish for the background. So the influence is zero for the background. And for derivations, they just have this form here. So if we consider the previous function equation here, and we modify it by the presence of gas monotone there, it would just be equivalent to change this box by another terms times box. So it will get you exactly the same kind of equation, just redefining the same parameter here, if you want, with another factor there, which depends on how much gas monotones you put in the box. So in particular, because the equation is just the same, the solution will just be the same, and it will just have some log divergence. And that's how the log divergence behave on both brain plus or minus. So here we just look at the Einstein equation. And it's true that the gas monotones might be able to affect boundary conditions and change them in such a way that they could maybe remove the log divergence. But if they were able to do that, the only way they could do this is by putting these two constants C1 and C2 to zero on both brains. And these constants C1 and C2 are what will be fixed by the junction condition and associated to the stress energy tensor we put on both brains. But the only way we can remove this logarithmic divergence on both brains is just by putting everything trivial. We just put C1, C2 to zero, H satisfied box H to zero, so it's completely independent of the matter you put on the brain. So this doesn't make sense at all. So it's clear from the example that because we can see the two brains simultaneously, you won't be able to remove the log divergence by the introduction of the gas monotones in the bulk. And it's very clear here because we really have the two boundary conditions. If you just had the one group and then some other boundary condition you put at infinity, then you could just think, oh, but I can put this constant to zero, and then on that brain you don't have the log divergence, and you don't care what's going on otherwise. And I think that's what's going on when we look at infinite extra dimension. Whereas we can see here that this is not a very physical thing to do, because if you did have one brain on the other side, then it just needs to put C1 to zero as well, and that won't be physical. So I'll just tell you how it seems to remove the log divergence in particular this paper, how introducing some Gauss Bernoulli terms, introduce the Gauss Bernoulli terms, and then how we see how we can work that. So for that, we consider Hubbin and Kick's theory. They look at this metric, and they smooth it out by the elements in Kick's theory, so just like the theory where you have going from one vacuum to another. Far away from the brain, well, close to the brain, but not exactly within the brain thickness, you have L going with an angle here. And then when you go within the brain thickness, it actually goes with another angle, such that there's actually no deficit angle. But if you're far away, you see that there's a deficit angle and a mechanical similarity, not here. So L prime is your relation with the brain tension. What it means in terms of L prime prime is that there is a it behaves like a delta function. In particular, when you take the brain thickness to go to zero, you have this relation. So L prime prime seems to go to a delta function times the brain tension. So now we look at perturbation around this geometry, and we can just look at the Einstein equations to see how they behave. So this is just the Einstein equation where I replaced the six-dimensional stress energy by I took a specific distribution of the delta function here. So this is the six-dimensional one. And this is equal, and if I decompose the six-dimensional Ricci tensor, it behaves like that. The M scale factor actually doesn't play any role at all. It's effectively one close to the brain. So I just remove it. And we have these two terms. So that's without Gauss Bernoulli terms. And these two terms seems to be really smooth within the brain. But now we can consider the presence of Gauss Bernoulli terms. And what they effectively do is introduce a term of that form within the equation of motion. And then we say that term behaves like a delta function. Here, then these two terms are smooth, So if we do that, we see that another thing to do is just to equate these two things, because these things are unnegligible, or they're completely smooth. So the only way we can make sense of this equation seems to be equate these two terms. And if we do that, we just have completely localization of gravity on the brain. This looks completely four-dimensional. And it's not that within a range scale, it's four-dimensional. It looks four-dimensional at any scale. And you can think of it because of this Gauss Bernoulli terms that introduce some things on the brain and which localize gravity. But in the VGP model, for instance, you have the same thing, you have the Hilbert-Einstein term on the brain. But still, it doesn't localize gravity. You don't have four-dimensional gravity at all scales. In the infrared, it's not four-dimensional gravity anymore. But here, it's really four-dimensional gravity at all scales at all, which is very surprising. As well, you can see that the size of the extra dimension is infinite, but the scale, the factor you have here is not infinite at all. It's just finite. And another thing I found very surprising about this result is that it's very local. It's just you don't solve the actual equation. You just have something very localized on the brain. So if you have this infinite extra dimension and you put a three-dimensional one brain at some point just to hold the same geometry, and then you put some matter on this brain, these three-dimensional two brains don't seem to see anything, don't seem to be sensitive at all about what you put on that brain. And you can put it as close as you want, it won't be sensitive at all. And I think this is really unphysical. And this is because you haven't really solved the Einstein equation. You don't really see what's the back reaction of the matter into the bulk and then how it propagates. You just have something very well, very much local. So I find this result very surprising. It's very nice if it's true, but it's very surprising. So we can consider the same setup, but instead of just equating the delta function, we can integrate over the brain thickness again. So this is exactly what we had before, with the gas undertones here, with the 60 mm stress energy here. It's exactly the same equation. But instead, I will integrate over the break thickness, so between 0 and epsilon. These terms here, L goes to 0 on the break, and M is effectively 1. So this term there is just a 4 to epsilon. This term here, I can integrate it exactly. And at 0, we want the derivative of H to be 0, just so it's smooth. But at epsilon, it doesn't necessarily need to be 0. So we just get the value of epsilon, H of epsilon. For this term here, it's as before, we had a delta function. So we can integrate here. And here as well, we just have the delta function. So we see that this is what we had before. But now we have this extra term here, which would be 0 or negligible if we consider this term to be 0 without having any effect. But really, it's not necessarily 0 at the end of the break thickness itself. And actually, this equation here, that without the gas Bernoulli terms, would be exactly what we had similarly to the Israel matching condition. And this is much more physical because it tells you how the stress energy on the break tells you about the very close variation of the metric close to the brain.
So your point here is that the Gauss Bonnet people are just wrong, and the reason they're wrong is that by doing a delta function, they missed this term.
Yeah, I think so. I think what they think is that they can evaluate this term on the other side of the brain, and it's just 0, and then it just gives you 0 here. But by the way, they can do that because they're missing some boundary conditions. So they impose too many boundary conditions at this point, and then they have no control at all of what's going on at infinity, but any other point. But I think this term is really crucial. It really tells you how it's going to propagate. If you forget about this term, you just have this. But you really should consider it in the first place, and then at the end of the game, decide whether or not it was negligible and neglected. But it will never be, because it really gives you some. It's really a different level than this one there. So I think this is the reason why they get a result which seems very physical to me. But it was seen that H goes like log epsilon. So although L goes like epsilon close to the brain, this term here, that could be really much the same order of that and should be considered. So we consider the presence of the gas Bonnet terms, and we can see that they do not regularize the geometry, or they don't allow you to get rid of the log divergence of both brains simultaneously. It seems that for an uncompacted pipe geometry, you could do that, but really the reason for that seems because you don't impose any boundary condition at infinity, or they don't, and so you impose too many conditions at the one point. What would be more physical to do would be to look at a warped extra dimension that's still infinite, but then you have more control of what you have to do over there, particularly you want your fluctuation or to grow higher than your background geometry. So to conclude, we looked at a regularized four-dimensional two brain by looking at a thick brain motivated by the Higgs theory. And for this specific setup, we tried to study the back reaction of the brain into the bulk geometry. We've seen that gravity looked four-dimensional to the lowest order at low energy, and we had a precise relationship between the fundamental gravitational coupling constant and the four-dimensional one. But then when we look at corrections to this zero mode, we see a lot of divergence coming in. And this log divergence is not removed by the presence of gas Bonnet terms. So it's really important to understand another way to renormalize these terms, either by what you said or by any other method. So I think this is really the direction we have to go into now, and this is where it comes.
Suppose you wanted to do a Randall Sundrum, one brain picture where you've got infinite, this big extra dimension and co dimension too. I remember the naive argument in the old days of the idea solid time was that the reason you needed the four brain was that the volume was infinite, even though it was warped. The naive application of Randall Sundrum to six dimensions would not have led you to a finite Newton constant.
For the model by Rybakov, it is actually finite. You don't need to put this.
That's not this. As I understand that model, they're not just using Einstein gravity with they're not using the same equation of motion that you would have been using here. Is that right?
They just use Einstein equations. Yeah, they don't look at the model, but then for the Einstein equation at the background level, we're not doing anything fancy. Just solving the same way.
Just for the background geometry, I thought that what I remember about ABS Alton is that if you just look at the warp factor, it just was, if you did the intervals, they were converging.
I think their argument is it is really finite. It is really finite, and that's how they argue that they have localization of gravity. Both scale factors in front of the x direction and in front of the angular direction go like an exponential.
I'm surprised by that, and maybe we should talk about it more afterwards, because I remember doing these intervals.
I think the general solution is actually blown up in the
it's a very specific case.
A very funny solution.
If you're very far away, it just looks exponentially, like it just looks exponentially like the Randall symbol too, and then you don't have a really notion of the presence of a brain at the origin. For that specific case, but they have to fine-tune their parameters for that. And if they take a specific general solution, in that case, one of the other goes up, or just goes to the constant, and then they
take the that's the thing of changing what's happening at R0.
Yeah, and that's what they have to do with numerical simulation. Really, it's really funny that at R0 you have something very funny, and you don't see it at all at infinity.
Okay, so the question was going to be that in your case, what I'm getting from you is that in the system that you look at, you're not in the Rubikov situation.
No.
So that if you took the infinite case with one brain, the old argument would have applied and it would have naively been an infinite volume. And so the surprise was that these guys found something localized, and you're saying that their argument is just that you're getting localized because they were doing ghost A, I think,
really localized to the Gauss planar, because I think the way it's localized is not so surprising, because then it looks like starry curvature of the brain. So but then as well, I think the neglect is to point it out. And surprisingly, it's purely four-dimensional, which I don't know.
But the message is the old message that unless you do the group cop kind of thing and you have a regular brain at the origin, that really you don't have an infinite random under the picture. So you don't know that.
Yeah, it's not enough. I think we should look for that.
So,
yeah.
So I'm confused by your conclusion. I mean, it seems to me, I have a two-part question. Is there a reason why this problem has to have a solution? That is, you're trying to study whether there are certain solutions to Einstein's equations with these other fields in a certain very special limit, where you regularize and you remove the differentiation. It may be that there is no solution to the problem. You end up saying the renormalization scheme has chemistry in order to tell, but that could also mean that,
It's possible we can't do anything about it, but you would expect that, it's possible.
So two questions. One of them is, there seems to be a reason why you think it must work, which wasn't clear in your talk, so what is that reason?
I just believe that if you work at low energy, then you shouldn't be so sensitive of really the high energy regularization scheme. That's all, I think. So you work in you really work at low energy, and then you would expect naively that it doesn't really matter how you regularize it and what's the scale at which you regularize it when you're working at low energy. So it's just like in gravity.
Gravitational fields get very strong near point on. I considered a shell of mass and charge in any dimension of Einstein's equations, and I try to shrink, and I solve Einstein's equations, and I shrink the size of the shell to zero, keeping the mass at infinity fixed. I'm going to run into a lot of singularities. If I try to perturb around that, it's going to blow up in my face. So that's true already in 3 plus 1. So why should it be any easier in 5 plus 1?
Well, everything doesn't blow up like crazy in this case. You just have a very nice low divergence, which is not that crazy. And you get things. At some step, you can check within what you would expect, and it really gives nice result.
Except for the log divergence.
Yeah, except for the log divergence, but it's not. If you have log divergence, it's not like it was blowing up like crazy, though. And you can think of ways to renormalize it. I mean, if you spend 10 years of trying to do it and you still didn't find anything, then I would take your approach. But
now let me ask the second question. Okay, so I mean, what's at stake? I mean, is this a problem that it's worth 10 years? I mean, supposing there is no solution to the problem,
we're already feeling some ways of solving it, and I gave one approach that might give some sensible answer. So as soon as you feel you're getting close to it, I think it's worth trying to go within this direction.
Sure, but still, I mean, what is at stake? Supposing that there is no regularized solution that in the limit makes sense. What would have to be given up if there is no solution?
Well, I think ultimately I would go to someone which is specialized in this problem much more than I am, and maybe he is able to see straight on that such problems have no solution at all. I don't know. But I still have to.
Infected field theory has been given up.
Yeah, can I jump in? I'd say that there has to be a solution, because the thing at stake would be that if this was true, that you could renormalize it and there's nothing else funny, then the statement would be that effective field theories would have said that quite generally, if you can arrange a hierarchy of scales and you believe all and you're in a system where you understand what your line types are working, or it's not something really bizarre, like pretty bit of singularity.
But I don't see why. I mean, effective field theory is a concept in quantum field theory. I don't see any. There was no quantum mechanics coming into this problem at all.
Well, so it holds in that last limit in particular.
Yeah, but it's just a problem about, as far as I can tell, I mean, there is an issue about effective field theory, et cetera, but the problem that it discusses is just a problem in general relativity.
Which effective field theory should apply to, but it should be that whenever you're in hierarchy scales, you have a local description at low energies based on essentially, you know, pretty general principles like the uncertainty, and so that should apply to the classical limit as well. And so it'd be a big surprise to find that there was a gravitational situation where there was no singularities and everything you really did have a hierarchy of scales.
And then the singularity theorems violate all that intuition all the time. I start with nice and I end up with singularities, and that's generic. So
that doesn't disagree with the effective field theory statement, because that just says that if you start off with a smooth thing, you can get driven out of the domain of validity of effective field theories, and where you don't believe.
But not just you can, you always do.
Right, that's why that doesn't mean that you can't expect field theories anywhere. It just says that the effective field theory statement is that if you have that was the first part. If you have a hierarchy of scales, and you are in a regime where you have a hierarchy of scales, and you are not in a singular region where there's singularities, you don't believe your equations, then it's always true that you can describe the low energy limit of that system in terms of a local interaction. And the fact that there are some places where you get driven out of that approximation doesn't mean that if the assumptions were true, that you have an effective field description. It doesn't say you always have to have it in the future. But the fact that the singularities exist doesn't mean that the physics is going to change on the Earth, for instance. Right? There are regions in which you're not driven to the singularities, and you should be able to understand that reason scale. And she's been careful to keep singularities away from the problem, make everything very smooth, and so it should be prepared for worse.
Okay, let's move to the speaker.